And welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that helps you to decode tomorrow by hearing from the people who are either making it today or, in the case of our next guest, the author and futurist Herman Konings, who are actually forecasting tomorrow today, if you follow my drift. Herman, you're very welcome.
Well, I follow your drift, and I'm thank you inviting me, Martin, for your podcast and being the host of, I think, an interesting podcast. So,
thank you.
You have one extra member, listener.
And one extra follower, and I think it's interesting that, as we'll find out, you know, I called you a futurist, but your actual job description and title, I think, is far more complicated and interesting. You trained, I believe, as a theoretical psychologist at, and I hope I'm getting the pronunciation right, at the University of Leuven, which I think is just east of Brussels, which, of course, will explain your accent for those people who are listening.
Okay, I'm a Flemish guy, indeed, Dutch-speaking. I've studied, indeed, in Leuven, or so also called Louvain, because a lot of international students are studying in Louvain, and don't underestimate Louvain. It is the second oldest university in Europe after Bologna. And at the University of Louvain, Vesalius, the one who invented anatomy, has studied and given lectures in the 16th or 17th century, I believe. Yeah. And in recent years, and this is typical Belgian, there was this professor, also a priest, named Georges Lemaître, who invented not only the idea, but also the name of the Big Bang. You know, the Big Bang was invented by
him. About the formation of the universe, indeed.
Yeah, but it's typical Belgium, and we are going to talk about Belgian schools, maybe, of futurism or forecasting. This is so typical. He is a priest. He is a priest at the Catholic University of Leuven, and he was talking about the importance of the Big Bang. Now, absolutely, how contradictive can you get it?
You know, what you are absolutely reminding of is, you know, Leuven has a huge reputation and also a great reference point for psychology, for example, and philosophy and theoretical sciences, which all of seem to be embedded in your title in some way. So my question, and I guess for a lot of people listening, this is a rather obvious one, you know, somebody who has a grounding in psychology and philosophy, in theory, how did you get over into the area of futures and future studies?
That's an interesting question, of course. Well, first, I went to the University of Leuven to study clinical psychology. I wanted to try to help people in their mental health problems, etc., etc. But after a while, I thought, it's too difficult for me. I'm empathic, but not that empathetic. So I'm into the drives or the attitudes, the behaviors of people, and trying to understand that in a more academic, scientific way. And this is what theoretical psychology is all about. Now, we call it theoretical psychologist. What I'm doing now is change psychology. I've taken the path to understand and predict, between brackets, the changing behavior of people. Why are you and I doing totally different things today compared to yesterday? And why will we change our behavior tomorrow? A lot of people ask me, but are we changing? I'm not into change myself. I don't like to follow the trends. And I say, well, take a photo book or a tablet with photos of only 10 years ago. And the first reaction you will give, looking at your own pictures, what was I thinking then? How was my hair looking? What kind of clothing, what kind of fashion I was wearing? But at those days, 10 years ago, this was what was happening to you. You loved that hairstyle and you loved that clothing. So people are changing. And what are the factors of change? And I was intrigued by that. And I still am. I'm now 30 years. In 1992, I started with trend watching. It was not known in Belgium. It was a little bit known in the United Kingdom and the United States, but not in Belgium. And it's all about the changing behavior of people.
So my question then is, when you hit at that point where you're thinking about, you know, taking where your original studies, you know, changing nature of people to the changing nature of, I guess, culture and of society. And then also mapping forward into how that affects the way we look at or perhaps even construct the future. Was there a moment in your career where you felt, okay, what I'm doing now is forecasting, or was it something that happened gradually and only when you looked back at it did you realize that you had in fact become a forecaster?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. In my career, it was a young career. I started when I had this degree of theoretical psychologist and change psychologist, and even more complex, I am a neurophysiopsychologist. So what is interesting also for me is the theoretical background of our brains and how our brains work when we are doing things we do and when we change. So I was thinking, what shall I do? And a colleague of mine asked me to follow him to this other side of Flanders, in the neighborhood of Kortrijk, neighborhood of Lille, very important, Lille, London, the Eurostar, to start over there a small company in market research. And I should be the expert in changing behavior. And then I was intrigued by a book. And this is 1991, December 91. I was buying books at the bookstore to give for Christmas in 1991, 30 years ago. And there was one book and I was intrigued by that. And that was The Popcorn Report. It was written, by, you know, The Popcorn Report.
Faith the reference Popcorn. Book. The first Faith and foremost forecaster, indeed, yes.
And why I was intrigued by two things. And this is explaining why I'm also a theatrical psychologist instead of a theoretical psychologist. This popcorn report, this was new in a way. First, she was using buzzwords. There were no buzzwords before 1992. She was talking about ergonomics and about, of course, cocooning. She had gained a lot of money by using cocooning as a trademark, as something that you should pay for. If you want to use the noun cocooning, you should pay her. She's absolutely became rich. That was one. Very intrigued by that. Secondly, and this is an interesting thing, I think, for myself also, her real name is not Faith Popcorn. Her real name is Vera Plotkin.
Indeed, yes.
And I was, why?
Nobody could have forecast that one or even predicted it.
Yeah, but she was saying, well, I have my little company in New York. No one knows me and the press is not interested in me. So I have to think in terms of creativity. And I'm trying to break the parity by using a name all people, all Americans know. First name. Faith is what I do. It's about the fatum, about the future, and et cetera, et cetera. My second name, my surname, no one uses the surname Popcorn. So I'm new, but everyone knows Popcorn. So I'm using the surname Popcorn. And I thought, well, this is interesting. This is storytelling. So the combination of storytelling and buzzwords and, of course, the academic cases and statistics inside the book was triggering me to do more or less the same, because the book was also translated in Dutch. But the problem is, it's so American. And I had the idea, I'm going to some clients and to say, let's look at the insights and the intel inside of the book, I mean the insights of Faith Popcorn, and let's translate the popcorn ideas of the United States into the Low Countries, into Holland and Belgium. So what are the differences, the cultural differences, making the statements of popcorn not so relevant for this part of the world? And what are maybe very interesting also to follow as a marketeer or as a decision maker? So this is absolutely my start. Today, I'm not a fan of Faith Popcorn. I'm not sure if you are.
No, I think
she is a pioneer.
Yeah, Robert, she's become rather antiquated and I think retrograde in her thinking. But more interestingly, and this is something that, that, you know, I will put back to you, because I think you're probably thinking about this yourself, her solutions or her insights were quite linear and didn't necessarily encapsulate what I would grade, you know, the great ethical or social or cultural questions or nuances. And this is something I wanted to kind of... you know, get you to kind of think a little more about from your years at Leuven and from the job you have done. And now that we're living in a culture and a society where we've had, you know, COVID, we've had COP26, we've got great questions about AI. How much do you think a forecaster now needs to be an ethicist and needs to be a moralist and somebody who really has to think about the bigger questions other than the, you know, the length of our hemline or the flavor of sweet or the color of car that we'd like to think about, which I think is how faith used to look at forecasting in those very kind of linear and rather bland terms.
This is a difficult one. The question is popping inside my head also for a few years. And I have to be honest, the last couple of years, I am becoming a little bit more the activist in a way, like you are also. And this is what I love about Future Laboratory for also nearly 20 years. From the time of the viewpoint in the early 21st century, not only to follow the financial profit trends, you know, but also asking the question, what is the impact of what I'm saying also for my audience, which is normal, not only decision makers, but also politicians, but also housewives or house men, I should say now, in terms of diversity, who are maybe having some problems in thinking at the future of their children or grandchildren, you know. And one of the ways I'm looking at the future, I'm not predicting the future, by the way. I'm imagining the future. In Dutch, it's beautiful. In Dutch, it's not voor spellen, predicting, but voor stellen, imagining.
Imagining.
It doesn't resonate in English, but in Dutch it resonates. It's about imagining without saying, because the future doesn't exist in a way, it's fiction. The future is per definition fiction. So it's about imagining, it's about guesstimating, guessing and estimating at the same time. And of course you see all these reports by scientists who have sorrows and concerns about the future. And I think maybe it's the psychologist inside me that I should also warn my audience of the consequences of, for instance, the metaverse or Bitcoin or the big tech companies. And what I'm doing now the last 5-6 years throughout Europe and even in the United States, they ask me for giving some insights on the financial world. The wealth company, you know, wealth banking, private banks, etc. Rothschild, for instance, or Citywire, or BlackRock. And I love to go over there to explain what is happening among youngsters and elder people and generations, etc., etc. But I always say, let me talk without decapitating me, because I want also to be critical
and challenging, exactly.
And what is the good news? The good news is, and you may also know that, they say, I love it when you are critical on our institution. So be critical in terms of...
So I think one of the things that money, you have identified there is that the future, as you point out, hasn't happened. It is about something that, you know, could and may happen. And I think to our point about examining the morality and the ethics and the, you know, the bigger questions, the bigger philosophical questions, is that if we do that, it can allow us to create potentially better futures, more optimized ones, and ones that I think are open to everybody. And the reason I'm kind of putting that out there for the moment is that when I was writing my book, The Trend Forecaster's Handbook, I came across three different types of school of thought about the future. So we had the American school, for instance, which was very much about keeping scenarios simple. So while people accept that you are looking at the future, you're keeping those scenarios fairly simple, fairly strategic, and focused on what I would call clear and definable outcomes. The second one, the European school, and I know that you can tell where I'm leading with this, that, which really was influenced by forecasters like Michel Gaudet, who was based in Paris, had a huge Cartesian, very much about rational thinking, but understood that the future had to be negotiated and argued, and also was potentially multiplex. So it was something that wasn't easy, and was almost the opposite to the American school. And then the third one, which, you know, growing up, I guess, from Ireland, but growing up in the English tradition, it's a school that majors on data, but actually still plugs into innovators, early adopters, and experts who are there to challenge. Now, taking those three different examples, you know, the simple, the complex, the data with possibility, is there a Belgian school that I could look to where you would say, actually, this is how we will do it in my neck of the woods, and we think that this is a better way or a different way of looking at tomorrow? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Interesting. Well, is there a Belgian school? It's not an institution in a way, like it is not an institution in Europe. It's a way of looking. Indeed, the difference is very clear. Europe, including even United Kingdom and the United States, and what you say, and Michel Gaudet, indeed. With his approach, I think that the French, between brackets, school is more like the way we in Belgium are forecasting. On the other hand, and it's even interesting to understand, I think the Belgian approach could be placed under the heading of the European school, but also we are Belgians, and you may know Belgians. We are a funny, slightly foolish, surrealistic country. Surrealism is very important. Also, the way we work in terms of looking into the future, the most globally renowned Belgians are fictional characters, you know? The most renowned Belgian all around the globe are people like Tintin, Lucky Luke, Hercule Poirot,
my favorite.
The Smurfs, and Jean-Claude Van Damme. So we are fiction, we are more or less, and this is so typical, we are surrealistic painters like Magritte and others are very famous, but it says something about Belgians and the way we look also, for instance, in the minds of people, psychology, or in the minds of changing people on their path to the future. It's a slightly surrealistic way. And what I mean is that I love to use statistics. I love to read the reviews and research done by others, of course, like what you have done, and you also use the research of the different market research agencies and companies all around the globe, and we try to indeed to filter that into the Belgian or the Dutch society, because our culture is different. And this is the way we are trying to understand what may happen also for our community. And then we do some research on our own. And what I am doing is getting the cookbook of psychology and trying to understand what happens in the United Kingdom or in Seoul or in Johannesburg or in Sao Paulo or whatever. Could this be also the case in Belgium? And then we have the scenario planning. But what is important, the surreal way of looking into the future is by being narrative. So the narrative way, the making of stories of a possible future is the way we Belgians love to do that. And we Belgians, and I'm not talking as theoretical psychologist being a trend watcher and a forecaster, but a lot of my colleagues who are more into digital transformation, you know, these digital transformation gurus, we have a lot of them Belgians who are absolutely adored by throughout the world. Like Peter Hinsen, I'm not sure if you know Peter Hinsen. He is renowned. He was raised in America, but is in Belgium. He has the largest number of Apple antiquities of Europe. He's very rich also. But he is a digital transformation guru who uses the power of storytelling. And I do make use of storytelling. And storytelling is very important because storytelling helps you to find yourself in that story. This is what I learned from my number one guru was not Faith Popcorn, but Watts Wecker. Do you know Watts Wecker?
Yes, because I actually quoted him in my book for that reason about the whole notion of the scenario, which, you know, based on the Hollywood notion or the French theatre notion of the scene and how if you could, I guess, buy into that and believe it and imbibe it, you therefore felt the things the characters were feeling. And if you took that into the future, it allowed you to experience the future, to either engage or disengage. But at that point, you could then recreate the future in a better system or a better model that allowed you and, I guess, the other people you want to participate in it. So I'm kind of sensing here also that from the, you know, from the Belgian school point of view, the use of narrative, the embracing of complexity, the empathy of story, the great trajectory that we tend to find in those grand schemes and narratives really, I think, do help people to understand tomorrow. And what I was really thinking about...
sorry for interrupting, but this is what is so... Typical, I think, for the Belgian school is the narrative, is the storytelling. Like what Zwecker told me, I've been having the privilege to meet him a few times, to get him over to Brussels a few times in the early 21st century. And he told me a good storyteller tells a good story, but a great storyteller tells a story that helps you to find yourself in that story. So we have to create a story to get people into thinking about the future. And this is storytelling. This is slightly surrealistic. And what is also important, and it is also an idea by Watts Wecker. Once a year, he was 5 days off being a pen handler, being a beggar in Penn Station, or being a hamburger flipper at Burger King to listen to what consumers are saying. And this is also what I, not 5 days, but I love to be the anthropologist by listening to what people are saying, not per definition in a scientific way, by doing marked research in a sterile way, but being literally within the system of people, where people are saying loud and clear what they feel. And this can help also in making the narrative, you're making the story that can be the story of the future. So this is, I think, more or less the Belgian school.
If I remember his quote correctly, he said it was the accidental voice of the crowd, you know, that moment where he is, to your point about flipping the hamburger
the accidental voice of the of indeed the crowd, which may not be taken as the reference frame. Of course, you have to dig in deeper. And to, for me, it's not per definition. I'm as a theoretical psychologist, I am was obliged to understand statistics. Well, I didn't like statistics, but now I do like statistics because, and this is also a warning. Today I say I love statistics. If you want to understand Gen Y and Gen Z, and you are talking about Zalfas, and within 3 years we start with Gen Beta being born.
If not another variant on
I don't
Gen
know
Z,
if
yes.
it will be Gen. I don't know if it will be Gen Beta. Maybe the virologists are saying no. The Greek figures are for us, not for you, trend watchers. But what is so interesting is that always we are talking about generations or men and women or people from here or from elsewhere in terms of central tendencies. We are using the central tendency like the mean or the average. We are using standard deviation. We are using the curves, you know. But it's also dangerous. There is a lot of differentiation within generations, within men-women differentiation, within the LGBTQKEIP plus differentiation. You know, you have the introverted people and the extroverted people. And introverted women are totally different compared to extroverted people. So what do? We take the central tendency, the average one. So I hope that every story about generations, and it's good, there are central tendency differences, but also is the story of the outside, yeah, the outskirts.
I guess, you know, if you think about every great film, every great book, it isn't about the ordinary. It is about the extraordinary, yeah, or it's about the complex of the puzzling. And one of the areas I'm most fascinated with, because I always think within what you're talking about is this issue of nuance and how we should look at cultural differences and shifts in terms of nuance. But I think, do you have a added complexity where if you have French speaking, Dutch speaking, German, Walloon, you know, does that make a difference or does it challenge how you have to go about creating, yes, forecasts and coming up with answers that apply to different, yeah, cultures, but perhaps have a common root or a common origin system?
Interesting that you are saying that, because indeed within Belgium we have the differences between the southern part and the northern part. And this is a long historical problem. It's absurd that we have two totally different cultures, a Germanistic culture, where you, the British, and the Irish and the Scandinavics, or the Scandics and the Dutch and the Germans are part of. We Flemish were part of the southern part of Holland. And then there was this King Philip II in the 16th century who wanted that Antwerp and Bruges and Ghent not to be influenced by Calvinist Protestant ideas, sex, drugs, and rock, well, baroque and raw. So he kept Antwerp for himself, and the Dutch were loose, and all the creativity and the money fled from Belgium, from Flanders to the north, to Amsterdam. And we were stuck within, between brackets, with the Romanistic part. And then Belgium was born, a marriage of reason. And this is interesting what you say. Is there a Belgian school? Yes, what is known for marketeers for, I think, 50 years now. Ask Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola. Belgium is a beautiful area. It's Europe in a small package. The northern part is more or less representative for Scandinavia, for the northern part of Europe, and the southern part, the Walloons, are more or less representative for the Romanistic part of Europe. So we are doing market research in Belgium, and we make split-run testing. We can see how different the northern part is reacting on new stuff, new concepts, compared to the southern part. And there lies, of course, the importance of Belgium as a split-run market research entity. And that was also interesting for me, because we have always to balance between what we are saying, between the observations in Flanders, in the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, and what we are saying in the southern part of Belgium. To be very honest, futurists, France is very important in terms of futurism, but in the southern part of Europe, trend watching is not so known.
Ah, interesting. And is that why? Because there's a distrust.
You have a lot of, the future laboratory can absolutely own southern Europe. When, from time to time, when I talk in France or Spain or Italy, they are surprised. We don't know that. And this, people ask me, where are the French or the Italian or the Spanish trend watchers or trend forecasters? And I don't know them. Yes, I can refer to Michel Godet or the future academic institutions in France. But the storytelling trend forecasters, not known. And if the French or Italian fashion industry wants a trend watcher, well, they take a Dutch. They take with all respect. And yeah, she's
Lee
perfect.
Everford, who's Lee brilliant, Everford. Yes, fantastic.
Yeah, she's brilliant indeed. So the southern part is, this is so difficult for trend watchers and my colleagues who are into future. We have sometimes to talk, of course, to our audience in two languages at the same time, which is, from a narrative point of view, killing the presentation. Because some French-speaking Walloons are not likely to understand the Dutch, and vice versa. You may think, oh, we Belgians, we speak three languages fluidly. This is not the case. So we have to rephrase what we are saying in Dutch again in French and the opposite. I always am very glad to do my things in Holland because there is only one language. It's the Dutch. But it's very difficult.
So I have, as you were talking there, I was thinking, gosh, you know, you've described quite complex systems. I think your review of how Belgian forecasters think reminded me of an organic process that I would be familiar with. And I think quite a lot of our listeners will have variations, you know, in their countries or in their businesses and organizations. But I just wanted to go back to you personally. So given your background, given the fact that you have to think potentially in three, maybe four languages, what is the methodology that you will use as a default methodology to realize some of your forecasts?
Yeah. Well, I use what I call the greatest hits album, you know. The stem, the base of my work is still psychology, the academic actual, of course. 30 years ago, I was having this degree of psychologist. 30 years later, there are new insights in that sports of psychology. So, but always I use the framework of psychology and generational thinking. And generational thinking makes use, of course, also of psychology and sociology. And then I follow more or less the scenario planning idea or the design sprint idea. So starting with analytics, with cognitive thinking, cognitive thinking, and why is that happening in the United States and should it be possible here? And what is the cultural observator thinking about that idea? What is the sociologist thinking of that idea? And so these people are being consulted, or we find in written research already, even by journalists, that they have done their work, and we take, of course, the insights of the journalist with us. And so this is the first stage, the cognitive thinking. Then cognitive thinking becomes creative thinking. Yeah? This is the way brainstorming works. Well, brainstorming, and you should. I've learned from you, it's dreamstorming, I believe, or heartstorming, or something like that.
It's all about not sometimes engaging the brain, but actually engaging the subconscious, so that you allow things
Absolutely.
To well up and to flood Absolutely. The upper part of the brain with a way of capturing a different sense of what tomorrow could be.
Yeah. Absolutely. What I'm not doing, and this is interesting, I have some colleagues also in Belgium who are into deep psychology, you know, psychoanalytics. I'm not using psychoanalytics. This is the world of the therapists, you know. They are deeping under the subconscious level, you know. What is deeper down your drives? What happened in your youth that is making you doing things totally different today? This is not my field of expertise. My field of expertise is using traditional factor analysis and statistics in what is happening and trying to absolutely filter out the wrong interpretations of statistics. Believe me, it happens all the time. People are saying, wow, the average Belgian is 13 hours a day working, living with a screen, which is not correct. It can't be 13 hours. There's a specific segment in the in the population that has 13 hours a day, work or leisure or whatever, with the screens in front of their eyes. But it's not the average, you know. So you always have to think also in terms of methodology. We've asked elder people, by using technology, by using the internet, what they think about something. But what with the rest of these elder people, a lot of elder people are not using the internet or are not interested by answering internet questions. So this is also something I like to point at. So creative thing is, of course, wonderful. What let's understand this and what may be possible in the future, taking into account some specific aspects like a sector. What about finance? What about health? What about wealth, etc., etc.? So take then the experts in these fields and let them brain slash dream slash heart storm. So you have the concepts. Then the next stage is my stage, the narrative thinking, you know. Make what we find, make a story out of that, and give that story to the ones who can create the future. Some are doing tactile, literally tactile thinking. They make something, they make a concept out of what they've heard on the changing behavior of people, and in the end make use of empathy. And empathy means give the views of the future to the audience, the broad big audience. What do they think of it? And what they think is not relevant, it's not important. We know that there are some scares, uncertainties, fears, doubts, etc., etc., because no, this won't work. Oh, no, no, no. But we know also that there are some other techniques, you know, contact conditioning, conditioning people by giving them frequent contact with new stuff, and they will follow. Mobile phone in 1992. Oh, no, never in my life I will use a mobile phone, was the reaction of most people.
Quite heavy, if you remember.
Yeah, all, but not due to the heaviness, but yeah, due to the idea. But if I need something, I ask my colleague or my mother, my neighbor, and I immediately got my, and not paying a few hundred pounds or dollars or euro for that. But we know that people are also to be influenced by social factors, for instance. So we take this into account, but we also like to ask people, what do you think of this kind of future or another kind of future? So this is the way I work mostly. But not all the stages are for me to be followed. Sometimes I end with the cognitive, you know, the research, and giving to my clients the greatest hits album of the research without saying what to do in terms of tactile thinking or empathy thinking or whatever. So this is how I work. What I like is the scenario planning, going to a negative scenario and backcasting. What shall we do to prevent this negative future? And it's interesting to do this also with a broader audience. And then they think, ooh, a negative future. This is the future of my children, grandchildren, grand-grandchildren. So let's indeed think in terms of not only recycling and climate awareness, et cetera, but in terms of fairness and fair trade, fair jobs, in terms of being kind to each other. It's like the priest on behind an altar saying his preaching about a few, well, preaching about his community. Well, I also preach about what may happen in the future and think of the consequences when we don't act today.
Oh, I have to say that is probably one of the most perfect and insightful summaries of how somebody goes about looking at creating, you know, the best most interesting forecast, because having interviewed many people, as you know, and asked them the same question, all had a vague sense of theory, a vaguer sense of practice, and worse, yeah. had no sense of logic to the vagueness or the theory or the practice. So thank you for clarifying that. And actually, that leads me nicely, I think, into my next question, because you, in your summary of how you look at the future, you refer to you know, psychology, the notion of the subconscious and the mind. And I noticed that your new book, which I think is your seventh, I'm not quite sure where you get time to write these books, because
seven.
Like me, you're traveling a lot, but it is called Gap the Mind, which as a Londoner listening, or somebody rather who lives in London, I'm familiar with this phrase from the London Underground, which is, of course, Mind the Gap. So is there a relation between your title and that obscure message that has now become cult following among those people who know and wear it on the T-shirt, which says Mind the Gap? So where did your title come from, and why is that your chosen for your book?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It absolutely comes from the underground, from London. You know, at a few times a year I come to London for my work, but also to come to the famous the Future Laboratory Trend Sessions. As from, I think, 2002 or 2003, when you started with that in the Goethe Institute, etc., I remember. And so, of course, if you are traveling to London with the Eurostar, then you take the underground. And Gap the Mind is absolutely also familiar throughout Europe, and everyone is referring to the underground. And even more than that, my book, This is Gap the Mind, has also the colors of the underground. And even there is relief, you know, the relief of the dots and the stripes for people with the visual problems, with visual impairment, who need a stick without falling down of the place where you wait for the trains to come. This is absolutely the starting point, but it's not about, of course, the underground of London. It's not about the underground of the future, neither. It's about the opposite. It's Gap the Mind means, gap is in my surrealistic way of thinking, it's stretch. Gap is not a verb, is it correct in English? It's stretch is a verb, you know. I gap the mind. You say I stretch the mind. But gap is indeed a gap. It's some vacuum between the left side and the right side. And if you open up the gap, you stretch the gap, then you stretch your mind. You know, you gap the mind. And gapping the mind is the consequence of crises, multiple crises, like a war, like a nature disaster, like an economic depression, and of course, like a virus attack, like a pandemic. And the idea was, and my publisher asked me, what will be your next book? Because in 2021, you have to write a new book. And I was sitting at home like you were and all the listeners were. And I had less work, less to travel, and less to give lectures, etc., etc. So I had more time, and I was intrigued by the impact, the effects, the possible effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the mind. The impact of this horrible situation on the mind, society, the market, on people, and so therefore the title Gap the Mind. Now, interesting is that it's focusing on the impact of the pandemic on civilization processes, and civilization processes are a synonym for mega trends. You know, since the Sumeric civilizations 400 generations ago, every generation gets on a higher level of civilization, between brackets, civilization. You know, mobility is a civilization process. more than 100 years, we had a cabbage and a horse, and it became a truck or a car, you know. This is a higher degree of civilization, but yeah, higher degree of civilization with more deadly casualties, with more people getting killed by a car, with an enormous impact on the environment, etc., etc. Yes, it is a higher degree of civilization in terms of economics and in terms of human development in a way. So we have to think of the side effects. The next stage is to lower the number of dead people dead by a car accident and to lower the emission problems by the cars. And so the next stage now is to get into these ACPS, mobility, autonomous, connected, post-fossil or post-fossil and sharing. This is the next stage. Also good, not only for sustainability, but also good in terms of killing people. More infrastructure, more safety in cars, etc., etc. So this is where the book is all about. We've described 10 of these civilization processes, and the mere observation, not given by psychologists to me, but by historians, that a crisis at large, an impactful crisis, has the likelihood of accelerating the civilization processes. Civilization processes go faster into the next stage and higher degree of level after a crisis, after a war or a pandemic.
Okay,
digitization, for instance, it went boom. It's a steroid therapy for these civilization processes. And this is what the book is mostly all about.
Perfect. To the point that I'm going to ask you to consider, from what you learned writing your book and the insights you discovered from looking at historical cataclysms or change, if I asked you to apply that to your knowledge now and then look forward 3 to 5 years, what are the big things we should now be looking out for, the big things that should be setting off alarm bells, or the big things that maybe should be alerting us to future opportunity?
Well, there are a few what I think intriguing and also described in my book. First, of course, it's all over the radio and television for weeks now, and months even. It's the mental health problems among youngsters, among people in general, due to what was the restrictions, etc., etc. This is not to be underestimated. So I'm not going to talk about that. This is too obvious. But what is interesting is also, and it has nothing, in first instance, nothing to do with COVID-19. It's the fleeing, the escaping of the generation Xennials, you know, the oldest part of Generation Y, millennials, and the youngest part of the Generation X, now between, let's say, 30 and 45 years of age, they are leaving the city. And they are more and more finding a dwelling in the rural or pre-urban areas. And this is interesting. This is interesting because the Xennials are having an urban mindset, because it's the first generation at large to go to higher education universities. They went to the cities, and now they find also the baby boom generation coming over massively to the city. The middle class baby boomer, double incomes, higher, not such a high education as their children, but still they have a lot of money, and they have no clue of what the world war meant for them. So it's not like their parents, they are not like their parents, who are very economic. They know about the war and about scarcity. The boomers want to spend. And now the boomers are more and more into retirement, having 45 hours extra free spendable time, having 2.5 times more money to spend. They are spending the money. But not like their parents. They want to have sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They are the sex, drugs, and rock and roll generation. They want to go to Glastonbury every year and to spend money at Tomorrowland in Belgium, which is the most, the largest techno festival in the world. And you'll find baby boomers over there spending a lot of money. And they want to go to live not in the countryside, but in the centers of the cities. And they raise the prices of the dwellings. And what should 30 up to 45 years old in their childbearing and rearing years do? They should have more space. They are in that city for 10, 15 years because they went to the city for study, and they stayed over there. They found their partner over there. And now at around 30 years, they have children, but they lack space, and space are very expensive thanks to the baby boomers. So they leave the city. And but what is so interesting is that the leaving the city for the rural and pre-urban areas with more space, with a garden where there's more oxygen because COVID-19 doesn't like oxygen. It's the enemy of oxygen. Youngsters take their urban mindset with them into the rural areas. And this is interesting. This is this clash of traditional rural areas getting a lot of youngsters with an urban mindset coming over to also influence the village with an urban mindset. And in the end, you'll get this progressive province. The provinces become, in a way, cities. And this is so interesting. And why is it also so interesting? What will they do in these rural areas, youngsters? Of course, they start a food truck and a tattoo shop and a hipster bar. But they also may be likely to stay in their larger houses than in the city to adore teleworking. And maybe to adopt the metaverse. You know, the metaverse works better when the real world is with trees and with space in your own dwelling. And this is what is interesting. This birth of a progressive province.
The birth of a progressive province. I think I really like that image there. Sadly, Herman, that's all we have time for this week. You can find out more about Herman and his work at www.hxt.be. My name is Martin Raymond, and you've been listening to Back to the Future. Until next time, let's keep listening, keep looking, keep learning, and keep asking what's new and what's next.